Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. And you've just got myself, Sal, and Glenn in the podcast room. Jeff is not joining us today. He is still up in Wisconsin. I don't know if he's ever going to come back, Glenn.
Well, yeah, we can always hope. No.
For those watching
we love Jeff.
For those watching on YouTube, Glenn is having a bad hair day. He's got his Premier Ag hat on. Looks like Joe Co-op over there.
That's right. I am Joe Co-op. Yeah. No, we all love Jeff. It's just, you know, you got to admit, when he's here, it's so distracting. His pompadour is so perfect.
The pompadour?
His pompadour. What?
We wish we had hair like that.
That's what it is. It's hair envy. But yeah, Jeff's hairdo is always absolutely perfect, right?
He's going to listen to this and call us.
That's fine.
All right. We got to start with the question of the day. Tell us about an interesting crop injury or crop damage story that you got that was caused by an animal that you had to do some detective work on.
Yeah.
I don't think I've got a very good one.
Yeah. So I think I've already told you about my vole experience where I was just sure that it was
that's a good story though.
Yeah. It was like an oil field artifact or it was an old clay tile. First of all, I think, well, it's gotta be a clay tile going up this hillside and I'm out there digging these giant holes. And then, you know, the farther I go, the more I cuss and carry on. And
what were you digging with?
A backhoe. Yeah. I was digging with a backhoe, but you know, a tile, you know, especially old clay tiles are typically like 30 inches deep because they were hand dug.
Yeah.
And by the time, you know, you take 50 years of weathering, 60, 100, whatever.
They're only 12 inches deep.
And I'm at like, you know, 8 feet deep trying to find something. And I'm finding holes, but no clay tile. And I'm just sure that it's the dead burn oil field guys, right? Because there's oil, you know, there's oil being produced on this farm. And ends up what it was vole colonies that water was going into the colonies at the top of the hill, eroding underground into the subsequent colonies down the hill and creating what looked like suck holes where tile gets if you crush a plastic tile, what it'll do is it'll rupture out, you know, make blow holes. And then where it goes back in, it'll make these suck holes. Right. And I'm just sure that's what it was. But outside of that, you know, I've run into probably 30 years ago, ran into hog damage over in Lawrence County.
Oh, yeah. And I remember that. It was, I don't remember you doing it, but we did have a hog problem. I haven't heard about them for a while.
Yeah, I think they got them all cleaned up, probably poisoned them or something, but, you know, trapped them. I mean, they're hard to all trap every one of them. It's hard to kill every one of them without using, you know, without using extreme measures, right? But I did probably the craziest, you know, everybody's probably one time in your career ran into goose damage in a cornfield or in a wheat field, right? It's hard to believe they'll saw off or
that
pull.
That was going to be mine. Yeah. It was goose.
Yeah. But I actually had, and of course, blackbirds, they're unusual. But I actually had a field one time over in southwestern Illinois that had raccoon damage, right? And they literally would go down the row and dig the seeds up and eat the seed off of the...
Really?
Yeah. The same thing that blackbirds do.
Yeah.
But this was coons. And they literally, you know, it was shallow planted corn, right? That was part of the problem was that they had planted too shallow. Corn emerged. And I guess they could smell that rotting seed. And they'd go down and eat nothing but the seed off of the mezcotyl.
I'll be dang. And pull up the little...
Yeah, they weren't eating the sprout. They just wanted the seed, right? Had that little bit of carbohydrates in the sperm.
We'll see turkeys do that, and they'll just I guess that was going to be one of my stories, either geese or turkey, but they'll just go down the row and just pick them right up.
Sure. Yeah. The you know, the turkeys get the blame. The turkey hunters, they want to gain permission. So if there's any kind of you know, any kind of damage. Well, you've got turkeys and we can fix that, right? But in reality, the blackbirds probably do a lot more damage. And you can tell the difference between, you know, guys like, well, there's holes out there. That's turkeys digging around. Well, turkeys make a big, you know, their toes are 3 inches long or 4 inches long. They kind of make a scratching, you know, they dig up, you know, several at a time. And I'm not saying that turkeys don't do that, but when you see those little tiny round holes about this big around, it's the most interesting thing to watch them. But blackbirds, if they ever imprint on a field, will come check that field you know, these are migratory birds, right? And they imprint on those fields and will come back and check them year after year.
Really?
And if you shallow plant corn, you can watch them go down the row and they'll pull up on the epicotyl, right? The plumule, they'll pull on it. And if they feel it move, then you'll see them start scratching around. If it breaks off, they'll just drop it. And you've seen that walking around the field where the plumules will just be laying alongside the row. And you'll see these little round holes about an inch in diameter. And that's where they stick their little toe in there trying to dig the seed out.
Those ornery critters.
They are on. They're aggravating little rascals.
Nasty.
Yeah.
Nasty
animals. Yep. But anyway.
Well, Glenn, you just finished up a round of anthropods.
We did. We had unbelievable participation this year. You can tell I'm getting
The sweat.
Yeah.
We definitely had precipitation.
Yeah, we had a lot of perspiration.
Boy,
we're all having trouble getting tongue-tied this morning. But no, just unbelievable participation. Even last night, right? We just finished up last night over towards Greensburg and had a lot of great questions from growers, and they seem like they're really interested in getting more, right?
Yeah. Some of the things that you were talking about a little bit, might want to review.
They've kind of heard about my stop, but the theme this year was really about getting more from your CPP, getting more from your, when I say CPP, I'm talking about your crop protection spend, getting more from your crop nutrition, getting more from your ag technology, right? It was about producing more with less, because, you know, it's no secret that we're in a tough time in agriculture right now. We got relatively low commodity prices, and inputs are not going to be cheaper this year. Growers are hungry for information, trying to figure out how they're going to make ends meet.
And well, there's only one way to do it when it's like this. I mean, you need more bushels.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right. And yet that's kind of the problem, right? The reason why we have low commodity prices is because we have this crazy, crazy carry out, right? I don't know if we're going to have 16.5 billion bushel production this year. You know, the experts and the crop tours are saying that the crop is not there, right? And that's one of the things we've addressed in these meetings, is talking about, so when you have high temperatures like we had this year in July and about the first half of August, you know, why does that have an impact on yield, right? So we've talked about that and talked about how to get more out of your crop protection spend by recognizing from the very get-go that there's this price to value among herbicides, right? And you may not see it that way. You may be, well, you know, these guys just gouge me for all they can get. Well, no, their job is to try to figure out what a particular chemistry is worth and then, price it in such a way that it looks more attractive than the competitive product, right? And so, price to value is really a fancy way of saying, you know, you get pretty much what you pay for. You pretty much get what you pay for.
I like the part of your stop where you talked about just the rates as we do. I think giant ragweed and some other weeds drove us to this, but a plan pass, you know, plan two pass where we put half of the or one third or half the rate down early. And I like how you described how we're kind of doing that backwards. We need to have a higher rate.
Yes. Yeah. It's about front loading, right? Yes. And so when you consider that it takes a certain amount of chemistry, right, regardless of the brand or the mode of action, most soil applied herbicide sal have a critical threshold that it takes to actually get control of weeds, right? And so when we go out there with a half rate, you know, in a split application, oftentimes that half rate is barely enough to get us over that critical value that it takes to actually get weed control.
Yeah.
And so instead of getting 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 weeks of residual control, giving us time to come back in and make our second pass, which hopefully gets us to fruition or gets us laid, what growers would call being laid by, gets us, you know, free to do other things the rest of the season. What it does is it oftentimes leaves a gap, and that gap, right? In other words, our first half rate got us maybe just to or just above critical value, and then it starts to wane. And before we come back to the second pass, we actually have water hemp emerge, giant ragweed emerge, fall panicum emerge, right? And once they're emerged, the residuals don't have the same effect, right? And so, yeah, I think we probably need to we need to communicate, whether it's the account reps or it's the growers, right? When we're putting our plan together in December and January, it's really about communication and being real with ourselves. what is the likelihood that we're going to be able to run triple reversals in the spring, right? Not to make a football analogy out of it, but there's times when we try to make this thing, especially when you try to trim dollars, right? Well, if I get the timing right and I can do this, followed by this, followed by this, you know, we can get perfect weed control. That's hardly ever the way it works, right? The first, you know, you soldiers talk about, you know, the plans go out the window when the first shot is fired. Yeah. Well, that's the way it is when you have a wet spring, right? You know, when we put our plans together, it's like, oh, I'm going to dance through the lilies and I'm going to make my burn down pass.
I'm going to come back in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'm going to come back in 3 weeks. That's exactly right. Yeah. Or we're going to plant and then we're going to cover this up at our leisure. No, you plant most of the time because you're trying to get ahead of the next rain event. And if you run off and leave that, and that rain event turns into 2, 3, 4 rain events, now you've got a field that is naked, that needs residual control as well as it needs to be burnt down again.
It's got to be rescued.
Yeah, it's got to be basically rescued. And the problem with that is this, right? A lot of the residuals that we use are actually coarse. They're hard on the crop, right? And so the more we can front load with those residuals that tend to not be so hard on the crop pre-emerge, yeah, we can basically use a heavier dose on those earlier. And then maybe if you're going to split, I still think a 2-pass program is ideally the best, right? But it probably should be more like 2/3 up front followed by 1/3. Right. Or maybe do 100%. Right. If your chemistry calls for, you know, 2.5 to 3 quarts per acre, you can either run 2 quarts and then follow it by 1 quart, or maybe just run 3 quarts up front. And then if you make a second pass, right, you make it more prescriptive in nature. In other
or
words,
giant ragweed or whatever.
Yeah, Johnson grass. Yeah. Right. And, you know, in southern Indiana, a lot of our 2-pass program, that second pass is really to clean up the void areas. Right. It's the edges of the field. It's the tile risers. It's the, mm-hmm, the oil field mess. It's the light poles. Right. It's these voids that will grow up in Johnson grass as soon as you leave them unprotected. Because remember, it's the majority of the heavy lifting is done by the crop, not the herbicide, right? If you've got a really vigorous stand at 30 plus thousand and you put the weeds on their heels, they never really can compete very well the rest of the season. Yeah, now there's exceptions, right? Yeah. Burr cucumber, giant ragweed, you know, there's some that will come fall panic, come a lot of times late in the season. We see hop hornbeam, copper leaf, right? Looks like tea weed, prickly cider, comes late in the season, typically doesn't have an impact on yield. But yeah, the trick is to get off to a good start and try to get a nice heavy layer so that second pass is a want to, not a have to.
Yeah. A couple things. I know we have beat tar spot to death.
Yep.
And its accomplice, Batman and Robin, Southern Rust.
Yeah, Southern Rust, sure.
So now it seems like we've done a lot of work and people have talked to death, but we're back to the part where you said a few years ago that we need to have a good vegetative application followed by, and kind of walk us through that for a grower as we're getting ready to go into harvest and kind of seeing the results of the fungicide applications that we made, which were about where we were last year.
Sure.
We're not too far off that number. But this seems like a way we're just going to farm this way.
Yeah.
It really does, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd love to say I told you so, but...
I've always believed you.
Well,
Jeff, on the other hand...
You think it's Jeff.
Would give you the side eye.
Actually... I appreciate this. And we've probably worn our listeners out talking about pathogens, talking about modeling. But, you know, it's just become proof positive to me that our strategy all along has been correct. Right. And it's not because we're that much brighter in southern Indiana than they are in the rest of the country. But in 2016, we had Southern Rust. 2017, we had Southern Rust, right? And we learned to manage around that, and that's making prophylactic applications. Because if you wait and scout until you have the pathogen, guess what?
Missed it.
Yeah, you've already missed it, right? And in fact, even Darcy Talinka with Purdue University, when she's talking about tar spot, right? And tar spot is different than Southern Rust because the latent period is about 3 times as long. So instead of 7 to 10 days, you're now talking about almost 3 weeks, right? So it's twice to three times as long, that latent period, that time between infection and actually having sporulation from the pustules or the stromata, right? And so so there is a difference between the two, but both of them have the ability to produce enough spores in a single generation to almost predispose a plant, right? So the subsequent generation can predispose that plant.
And what's that cycle? What's the sporulation? How much time, I guess?
Yeah. So the time on Southern Rust is like 7 to 10 days. It's relatively short, right? And and they sporulate pretty heavily. They're easily controlled with fungicides. In fact, it's not, it's not particular to any one, but there's some that work better, not because they're coarser on the spores or the germination of the spores or even the apersorium. It's more a function, you know, controlling Southern Rust is not about, killing them deader. It's about killing all of them, right? Because they, the cycles are so fast and there's so many spores produced that it's just hard to get enough coverage to get them all, right? And so, especially if you can, the reason why that V stage application, making it prophylactically at that V10 to V12 timeframe, the reason why that is so effective is it really hampers that first generation and cleans that plant up through about R1, right? Well, at R1 is when we normally would make a prophylactic application. The problem is that almost always runs out of steam,
yeah,
and you end up making an R4 application or R5 application, early R5 application. So yeah, our strategy has worked again this year. If you go to those fields that were sprayed at V10, V12, they came back not with R1, but more like R2.5, R3. And this year, those fields were so spotless.
That was amazing.
Yeah, they were just absolutely spotless. And now you see Southern Rust coming into them. But guess what? Those fields are now at like 3/4 milk line. They're fully dented. They're within a week of physiological maturity. And I'm not saying it couldn't have some impact on standability, but those growers are not going to experience a bunch of yield loss, right?
No, and it is amazing. Once you don't realize how much disease and gray leaf spot and things that we got used to seeing over through the years. And whenever you see one that's been sprayed in vegetative application and then followed by an R3 or whatever we're going to do, to see how green that plant is and then to see it died senesce the way it's supposed to.
Right.
It doesn't look like what we're used to seeing.
Yeah. Right? We got so used to watching plants, some people call it ghosting. Some people call it tip dieback or top dieback. To me, I just call it graying out, right? We got so used to going past fields at 60 mile an hour and there'd be green plant, dead plant, dead plant, green plant, dead plant, green plant, dead, green, dead. Yeah. That's not the way corn is supposed to. It's not supposed to work that way. And it's not supposed to consume from the bottom to the top. The plant really should stay green and the shucks should be the first thing to become necrotic, right? Yeah. And then the ears hang down and there's no harm or foul with shelling corn that's still got a fair amount of green in it, right?
Last topic, crown rot.
Yeah.
So give us the 2-minute drill. I know Donovan up at Greensburg, you and Donovan have done quite a bit of plot work.
Sure.
So kind of catch us up on how that came to be and where we're at today.
Yeah, no, that's great. So we're talking specifically about red crown rot. So when we talk about crown rot, we're talking about Fusarium species typically in corn, and that's a big deal. That's what normally causes, this ghosting of plants, this top dieback, this graying out of corn plants. But yeah, we have an area within Premier Service Area, like Northern Decatur, Southern Rush County, that has really become a hotbed for red crown rot. And red crown rot, if you're not familiar with it, is a soil-borne pathogen that is native in this country already to areas like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, right? So in the southern delta, they've had this disease for some time, and they typically use resistant cultivars and seed treatment to combat it. Well, a couple of years ago, it started showing up here, right? And they've got a hotbed or two in Illinois. This year, it was found as far west as Missouri, but You know, the folks up at Greensburg have had this now a couple of years.
Why?
It probably got moved with farm equipment, right? So the disease is a Calenectrium, and it is not Fusarium, but I would point out that if you picture it like Fusarium, that's not totally wrong, right? So Calenectrium, Iliacola, that particular organism, even though it's not a Fusarium, is in the same order as Fusarium. So if we were talking about insects, something that's in the same order, say the order of Coleoptera, would be all the beetles. If we're talking about moths and butterflies, that would be Lepidoptera. If we're talking about, you know, the true bugs, those are Homoptera, right? Or excuse me, Hemiptera. If we were talking about flies, those would be Diptera, and wasps would be, you know, wasps and bees would be Hymenoptera, right? So red crown rot is not a Fusarium, but it is in the same order, and it is a soil-borne pathogen. Typically, it is spread across distance by mycosclerotia, and sclerotia is a fancy way of saying like hardened mycelium. So if you think of a fungus, you know, a fungi as like a plant, the spore would be like the seed, and the mycelium or the hyphae would be like the vegetative part of a plant. And then the fruiting bodies would be like the ear or the fruit, right? Does that make sense?
Yep. So they get spread physically?
Yeah. Typically, we are probably moving it with farm equipment, right? We're moving it with residue, because when you cut soybeans down low, you're cutting them right down there where those pustules were. So it's possible you're spreading spores. It's possible that you're spreading hyphae that is basically on the residue, or you're moving it with soil from. And by the way, you know, in the 21st century, you know, we trade farm equipment across the Corn Belt like it's nothing, right? Sure. You know, the trucking is ubiquitous. There's trucks moving east to west every day. And so it's very probable that we've moved it that way. It's possible that we've moved it even with seed, right? We don't like to think that it would be a seed-borne pathogen, but if you have dust, right, that's getting in the combine, and we blow the majority of that dust away, it's still possible that you could have, you know, this sclerotia, in this case, it's microsclerotia that is infecting or getting on the seed. But okay. That's one of the reasons why we really promote the heck out of seed treatments. But anyway, back to what's going on here locally. Syngenta approached us this spring and said, hey, you know, we've got a product that is not for sale, but it is, because it's a regulated product. We do fully expect it to get registration maybe in the fourth quarter of this year. And we were wondering if you could put some trials out for us. Well, come to find out, they only have 3 units of this for this part of the world, right? And so in Indiana, I think it's Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. So the tri-state area had 3 units. They came to Premier, wanted to know if we get these out. And I was like, well, you know, we don't really have, we have one area that is, which has a real problem with a red crown rot. But, you know, the product is for other, you know, other soil-borne pathogens like Fusarium. And I was like, sure, you know, we'll put some out. I've got one of the trials over on some falling beans over my part of the world. Locally, we've got some here not far from Cortland, just west of Cortland, that's on some ground that's rotated. And then the third plot, Donovan Meyer, got positioned in a neighborhood that is known to have red crown rot. And it just turned out this year that it couldn't have been in a better spot, right? So, you know, what there was in this particular trial, there was an NK variety that they said was totally accidental, that it was like the canary in the coal mine.
The worst susceptible.
Yeah, it apparently is a really susceptible variety. But yeah, they basically had some Cruiser Max Apex, which is a facsimile of like Warden CX2, right? Yeah. So those products are sister products, slight difference in the rate of picarbitrazox and mefenoxam, right? One has more of one and one has more of the other, but they're basically facsimiles. So if you consider Cruiser Max Apex or Warden CX2, and then it was Warden CX2 on the other side of this block with Saltro. And Saltro is an SDHI And it's probably third or fourth generation, right? It's the active ingredient in the Miravis brands. It's the active ingredient in Saltro, right? So this Saltro product has been really good for, for Fusarium vulgariforme, or what most people would know as SDS. But even though they have like an emergency, even though they list red crown rot on the label, it's been unclear just how much control we're getting. And then in the middle between these was this new product that is registered. So, this is not for sale. It is currently it's crop destruct, right? So we'll have to actually destroy these acres if it doesn't get registered. But the technology is called Timerium, and it is a new SDHI. Let's call it, if Saltro was fourth generation, let's call this fifth generation. Okay. And it's going to be called, if it gets registration, Victrato. And this Victrato molecule was just unbelievable. So when you see this plot, it started showing up a month and a half ago. And when Donovan first called me about it, it's like, oh, Donovan, you're imagining this, right? I basically put him off. It's like, no, you're just seeing stuff. It's probably something else, right? And then when we first saw it, it was like, oh my gosh, this looks like we have a macrophemina, something like charcoal rot, because it was coming in crazy early. Wow. And so, this was back in mid-July. And so by the end of July, it became obvious that it had a real problem. By the first week of August, you could see the little red fruiting bodies down there on the stem. And those are called parathecia. And of course, then the folks from Purdue came down this is a technology that has real promise for growers with this problem. Because Sal, I don't know if you think about we always bring this kind of around to the psychology of farmers. Can you imagine planting a soybean crop with any confidence to put on multiple fungicide passes, to put on fertility, to try to keep it clean of weeds, knowing full well in that neighborhood they might die off prematurely and you're going to get 30 or 40 bushels?
I can't imagine. That's why sudden death is so emotional. There's no, the economic thresholds are so hard, but it is just emotional.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you see drone photographs of this plot, and by the way, we showed those at our answer plot meetings, where, everything in this corner of the field is, in this plot is infected, including the competitive brands, the things like Saltro, even at a 2X rate, still had the symptomology. Wow. And then from the air, you see this 140-foot strip going the full length of the field with absolutely no plants infected. It makes an impression on you.
It's so visual.
Yeah, it's very visual. And so we're excited. We're trying to be, trying to keep it in check because, again, it's not a registered product, and we certainly don't want to inhibit that, right? So we don't want to promote it too aggressively.
Neat that you are on the leading edge of this one.
Well, it is. It's not necessarily that I'm on the leading edge. It's that we are on the leading edge, right? The fact they came to Premier and said, hey, we know you guys have some red crown rot. Can you get this position someplace? And then they had the wherewithal to not put it all where there was, please put this someplace where you have beans following beans, because there are other. Yeah, I mean, it's not like, unfortunately, in pathology, because it's so difficult to make diagnoses, most diseases either go undiagnosed or underdiagnosed, right? Or misdiagnosed, right? And so, there are, I don't even want to put a number on it. We know that there are hundreds, if not 1,000 plus Fusarium species that affect row crops. And in fact, several years ago, one of the worst Fusarium root rot infections I ever had personally was when I planted beans behind 12 years of continuous corn.
Really?
And the beans died off in mid-August. I mean, literally just croaked. And I actually had to bring George Waters at the time. George, was prior to George retiring. And I brought George Waters in. I was like, George, I said, I need a second set of eyes. Please tell me what this is. Because it looks, kind of looks like macrophemina. It has a symptomology of SDS. The root symptomology looks like Fusarium. And he's like, oh, yeah, this is just Fusarium root rot. And so, you know, after 12 years of continuous corn, that would lead you to believe that probably that's a pathogen that spans between corn and soybeans both, right?
Has to.
But, I mean, again, there is a whole plethora of soil diseases, soil-borne pathogens that can infect soybeans as well as corn, that, boy, it'd be nice to have another tool in the toolbox. And you know, I've done work with that, right? We, a few years ago, we did trials putting prothioconazole in small plot demos, right, where we had an exception, and found that there was some pretty good utility on crown rot. The reason why we never could go forward with it is because they ended up using a smaller rate of it as a seed treatment as opposed to an in-furrow treatment. And if we put the two together, then we'd be over the, you know, we'd be over the maximum rate. We have found that things like flutriafol, which is active ingredient in Xyway, has some activity. And so, yeah, we're, you know, here's what growers need to know. We are well-respected at Premier amongst the basic manufacturers for being able to make these kind of trials and help collect data on this sort of thing. And it should tell our growers that we're in a leadership position, right? That we're actively looking for solutions to their problems. Most times in agriculture, you come up with a solution and then we draw attention to the problem, right? That's kind of the way that normally works, right? We've got a new product for X and then we find X everywhere. And in this case, this is where we had the problem. Let's call it Y. We had problem Y, and the solution came to us, right?
Nice.
Which is the way we really would like for it to be.
All right. Well, you are leaving tomorrow, 40th anniversary?
Yeah. Well, it's in September, but yeah, we every 5 years I try to take my wife somewhere on a, you know, an nth romantic backpack mule deer scouting trip.
Backpack mule deer scouting trip.
And this year we're going to go where I really have no intentions of going back to hunt mule deer. So
nice.
We're going to run around the Cascades. I would say there's one thing really selfish. I'm going to try to go down to the Palouse. I'm hoping that they're still harvesting spring wheat. I've always wanted to see the Palouse is that area in southeastern Washington where they have the side hill combines. And
that'll be neat.
Yeah, hopefully.
Take some pictures.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I'll take lots of photos. But anyway.
All right. Well, you all have a safe trip. You're driving out?
No. We're going to fly to Seattle and then rent. We got a car rented.
Good deal.
Or a vehicle rented.
All right. Well, you have a fun trip.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.